I'm going to offer you a short reading, and in fact, it is the text of my newsletter column. I have decided, since it's coming somewhat late in its printed form, it deserves to be delivered as a spoken word document. After only a month into the new presidency of Donald Trump, I find myself reading and musing over the lines of W.B. Yeats's famous poem, The Second Coming, the most thoroughly pillaged piece of literature in the English language I have read. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity, and what rough beast its hour come round at last slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. Having read that and become somewhat despairing, I found some hope in these short words by Virginia Woolf written in her journal. The future is dark, which is on the whole the best thing the future can be, I think. We often mistake the darkness as something terrible when it is, in fact, mysteriously inscrutable. These are dark days, and like many of you, I have become addicted to watching television on television news late into the night to help me navigate the darkness of my anxious uncertainty following the inauguration of our new president. The thin thread of reassurance that Virginia Woolf offers me is the hope of uncertainty rather than the fulfillment of all my dread and worst nightmares. While I can no longer hope for the fulfillment of my dreams, at least in the near future, I still have faith in the unpredictability of the world. The despair I experienced while watching the presidential inauguration was lifted the following day with the Women's March on Washington, D.C., and marches all over the world, including here in St. Louis. The world is wilder than my own dark imagination. Rebecca Solnit, in her book, Hope in the Dark, reminds us that history does not march forward like an army in a simple straight line of cause and effect. History is a crab scuttling sideways, a drip of soft water wearing away the stone, an earthquake breaking centuries of tension. Sometimes a few passionate people change the world. Sometimes they start a mass movement, and millions do. Sometimes those millions are stirred by the same outrage or the same ideal, and change comes upon us like a change of weather. Remember when unexpectedly the Berlin Wall came down, along with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, or the end of apartheid in South Africa? What I find hopeful is that anything could happen in the next few weeks, months, the next 4 years. The American people are anxious and restless, and whether we act or not has everything to do with it. Everything begins in the imagination, in hope. But to hope is not to simply dream. It is to gamble. It is to bet on the future, on your desires, on the possibility that an open heart and uncertainty are better than gloom and safety. To hope is dangerous, and yet it is the opposite of fear, for to live is to risk. My dangerous hope-filled dream is that we, as a prophetic and activist religious community, will become a sanctuary of hope in a time of national despair for the majority of Americans. Hope does not mean sitting on the sofa or in the pews waiting for the next presidential election, or even the next settled minister for that matter. Hope is better understood as an axe with which to break down the doors of our apathy and despair and then shove us out the door. The church canvass begins next week, and there has been much discussion about the needs of the church, the budget, and how to secure the financial support of the church by the generous contributions of church members. For the moment, I want to forego all the many marketing schemes that are oftentimes entertained and simply suggest we proclaim our commitment to making our hopes real. The work of hope, in contrast to a vague optimism, will require us to throw ourselves actively into what is becoming, to make a commitment to that to which we wish to belong. To commit oneself to the future is to make real our dreams for the future. This, like love, is always a risk and a gamble. Where is the joy in this commitment? The return on your investment. To hope is to give yourself to the future, and that commitment to the future makes the present itself inhabitable. The future is dark and uncertain, but is that darkness of the womb or the grave? It is not a time to be lazy or detached. The future of this church and its mission in the world needs your commitment and generosity. Anything could happen, and whether we act or not has everything to do with it. We are the keepers of the faith. You can get that in a text copy this next week. Well, some of you may have noticed in the order of service, my sermon title is different than the order that the title on the cover. I've added the word tangiblate. I don't know that any of you have heard of such a word. Well, tangiblate, what does it mean? Is that even a real word? It's not to be found in the Oxford Dictionary, neither is it to be found in any foreign language or an ancient dialect. It does look a little like one of those strange words Dr. Seuss creates when he writes one of those surrealistic children's stories. Perhaps some of you wondered if I was suffering from a moment of extreme dyslexia combined with bad spelling and my typing disabilities, or simply what happened to spell check. Tangiblate was a word coined by the famous mid-20th century evangelical preacher heard live on the radio all over America every Sunday morning, Billy Sunday, the Billy Graham of his day. The Reverend Billy Sunday used to talk about stewardship in the church as something that helped to tangiblate, that is, to make tangible people's values. When I first read this word, the song that came to mind was the Three Dog Night song, Celebrate, Celebrate, Dance to the Music. But I thought, tangiblate, tangiblate, called by the Spirit. Maybe we can sing that together. Some of you are probably taking a deep breath and muttering to yourselves, if I knew the sermon was going to be about money, I would have slept in. Let me reassure you that I intend to talk about a lot more than money this morning. I want to talk about money and the meaning of life. I want to talk about who we are and what we treasure. This morning, I want to address the religious dimension of money. I want to raise our consciousness about what money represents so that we can better understand how it influences our emotional and spiritual lives. I promise not to use any pie charts or diagrams displaying how the money you give to the church this year will be used to make repairs, pay staff, and sustain programs. I will leave that to Dan and the Canvas Committee. I hope all of you will sign up for one of the many Canvas gatherings that will be taking place here in the church over the next few weeks and months. Your attendance should be considered what I believe to be an obligation of church membership. I hope you look upon it not as a burdensome obligation, but rather as a duty of the heart. Talking about money is always difficult. Every year about this time, I have to confront the challenge of doing just that. I have frequently described money as the last liberal taboo. Organized religion has been involved from its beginning in a primeval past in marking off what is taboo. And in contrast, liberal religion traces its history as a movement in organized religion through a long line of heretics, such as ourselves, those who spoke out against and challenged the taboos of the day. We are builders of the free church, affirming the priesthood and prophethood of all believers, transgressing the boundaries, limits, and taboos that would fence in the spirit and obscure the truth. Their heretical gospel, their liberating good news, argue that there are to be no boundaries to inquiry, no topic to be fenced off or left unexplored in the search for beauty and truth, love, and justice. Nothing is so sacred it cannot be discussed. We have a proud history of being a beacon to the progressive forces of the day, welcoming all men and women, regardless of race, creed, or sexual identity, giving rise to a broader fellowship, builders of the church universal. But proud as we can be of our taboo-breaking past, the one area where we have maintained somewhat of a holy silence is, as you have already guessed, money. The last taboo of liberal religion. In many, many of our congregations, money is marked off as a topic that is unsafe for casual contact. It is not to be touched or handled in an open and frank manner. There is a kind of don't ask, don't tell pledging policy, with all documents regarding pledge levels locked away, accessible to those select few who have been given the secret code. As you can imagine, this constrained and repressed approach to money makes the annual canvass quite a challenge in many of our congregations. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. A colleague and friend of mine who had come to the ministry as a second career was being interviewed as a ministerial candidate to serve one of our older congregations in New England, a 300-year-old liberal Christian First Parish Unitarian Church in Massachusetts. My friend, the candidate, before meeting with the search committee, had also interviewed the previous minister of this historic congregation. The previous minister warned him that the church had a history of financial problems and had fallen into the bad habit of using its endowment to pay staff and maintain the building. Its sound financial days were numbered. The interview followed the usual pattern, with the candidate answering questions from the committee, who were diligently attempting to determine whether he was qualified to be their religious leader. At the end of the interview, this candidate did something different than the previous candidates the committee had interviewed. He proceeded to question and interview the committee. He picked up the congregational profile that included demographic information about the church, the number of members, pledge levels, the annual budget, etc. Reading the job description for the minister, he said to the committee, "Now, what is it that you mean when you refer to the freedom of the pulpit?" There was silence around the table. Two people coughed. Two or three chairs scraped on the linoleum floor, and the chair of the ministerial search committee said, "That means you can preach and teach about anything you want." "Anything?" he asked. "Well, anything except money." That issue, how much individual members will pledge, we leave to the individual members to determine for themselves. My friend just looked at the committee and then said, "That's interesting. Neither the minister or the lay leadership is allowed to talk openly about money. Tell me, what kind of Bible do you have on your lectern? Is it some kind of new abridged version I'm not familiar with?" Remember, this was a 300-year-old liberal Christian Unitarian church with a Bible that was almost as old on the lectern. The search committee just stared at him, and he repeated, "I mean it. What kind of Bible do you have on your lectern?" And the committee looked at each other and finally admitted that they didn't know. "Well," said the candidate, "would you mind bringing that Bible down here so we could look at it?" The committee looked at the candidate, and the candidate looked at the committee. And finally, two members of the committee got up to go and get the Bible. Now, this required two people because this was one of those 200-pound King James versions of the Bible. And it had been sitting there for so many years, the leather had adhered itself to the wood of the lectern. The two men had to apply some bit of force to move it. Then they carried it down and put it on the table in front of the candidate. For the next 8 to 10 minutes, the candidate proceeded to go through the Bible one page at a time. He began with Jewish scriptures, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and proceeded all the way through the Christian Gospels and Book of Revelations. He was flipping the pages very quickly, I think. And when he got to the end, he said, "I don't understand it. You haven't cut a thing out of the Bible." The committee, dumbfounded, just stared at him. He said, "If you really don't want me to talk about money and possessions, you are going to have to cut out about one-eighth of the Bible, because one-eighth of it talks about how you use your money and possessions in direct relationship to what you say you believe. In the Bible of the Ten Commandments, three provide instructions on how you are to use your money and possessions. Of the 38 or so parables of Jesus, 16 deal with the relationship between what you say you believe and how you use your money and possessions." If you are wondering why money and possessions are referred to so often in the Bible, it is because money is an incredibly powerful force of life. Money represents the material power we possess in our lives. It represents our capacity to influence and affect others. The famous sociologist of religion, Max Weber, wrote, "Power is the ability to give a command and have it obeyed." Well, let me tell you, if you have a handful of money, you can make a lot of commands, and you will have a lot of commands obeyed. That's the power of money. Jacob Needleman, a professor of mine while a seminary student in Berkeley, California, wrote an insightful book, Money and the Meaning of Life. Our feelings for God, he wrote, that is, for being, for truth, whatever we choose to call the ultimate reality, pale when compared to the stimulations that survival and functioning in the outer world evoke. Money being the principal means of organizing and ordering survival in the outer world thus seems the most real thing in our lives. If we do not love God, that is truth, a truth larger than self, you will inevitably love and be possessed by money, there being, as it were, no other alternative. Everyone remembers the figure of Scrooge facing his old business partner, Jacob Marley, who has been stingy with his life and miserly in his joy, who you will recall tries to warn Scrooge, and Scrooge tries to comfort Marley. "Jacob, you were always a good man at business." And Marley shouts back, "Business? Humankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, benevolence, all were my business." Marley was one of those who never got his priorities straight, and he was unhinged and destroyed by his trivialities, consumed in essentials. All that was truly sacred and should have had priority went by the wayside and was lost in the lesser priorities of a narrow narcissism and desire for a mean success. And so Marley's spirit was vexed. We are, each and every one of us, given the opportunity to follow the advice of a revered Jewish man who lived over 2,000 years ago, a man whose life and ethical teachings can help us in putting our priorities in order, who said those many years ago, "Provide yourself with purses that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will be your heart also." Invest yourself in those things that have lasting and eternal value. Most of you are familiar with that popular quotation, which sometimes appears on bumper stickers, "He or she who dies with the most toys wins." It's been very popular in America. I have another old cartoon that appeared in a back issue of The New Yorker that I keep in my office that reads, "He who dies with the most toys is still dead." We tend to live as if we always have later, but of course we don't. We can hold on to things as much as we want, as hard as we want, but not as long as we want. We will take out of the world exactly what we brought into it. In the end, what will remain of us here is not what we hold on to, but what we gave away of not only our possessions, but also ourselves. I like challenging the taboos of the day, taboos that would have us fence in the spirit and obscure the truth. Honesty is very important in religion. So why should our candor not include money? Like my friend who was the ministerial candidate interviewed to serve that little church in Massachusetts, I want to encourage our canvas committee and all of us to not fall into the practice of stonewalling, pretending, and playing games when it comes to money. We need to be more upfront with our fiscal honesty in church life. Why should money be our one hidden, unmentionable subject in our relatedness together? For example, no one has ever told me that they think it unreasonable that my income as a minister is public knowledge. It is there in the annual budget. If every member of this church accepts that my remuneration is open so that members can vote on it as they do each year, then how can any embrace a double standard in which everyone else's income should be hidden? Do we believe this is a fair process? Do we believe that ministers are some lesser minions who cannot enjoy the fiscal privacy that some defend so rigorously for themselves? Frankly, I think it would be healthy if we could have a church in which all of us could be forthright enough to reveal our incomes and all pledging be made public and transparent. Unitarian Universalists make a great proclamation of openness and candor, but too often we want such honesty everywhere, except in dealing with money and being upfront about our own fiscal resources. It is also time that we stop hiding from one another and accept that in church, where we glorify differences and variety, that part of that diversity is the reality that we receive different incomes. Doctors and lawyers make more money than teachers and social workers. Many of our young adults are burdened with college debt and are receiving modest incomes in the new market. Why do we need to hide such a secondary import in our lives from one another? Or are we really saying that for all our pretensions of human equality, we still worship first and foremost our dollars, keeping them sacred and silent? A truly democratic church intent upon living with the integrity proclaimed in our Unitarian Universalist principles would be honest, democratic, and straightforward about money in church life. I want to submit that to openly discuss the canvas, good stewardship, and fair share pledging, where your pledge level is determined by your income, is a religious and theological exercise of profound import. It is a call to integrity. The annual canvas is a powerful teaching moment, providing us with the opportunity to help us think through and contemplate what is worthy of our devotions, what we truly value, and how close we are living our values. We can do with our lives what we have so often promised with our lips. Having talked the talk, we can now walk the walk. Stewardship and our generous pledge contribution helps us to tangiblate our lives. Remember, tangiblate, called by the Spirit. Tangiblate, called by the Spirit. Consider this year's canvas as an invitation to value this church and congregation, the work of the church, and the meaning it provides for all our lives. The church needs your support. More importantly, it needs your honesty and your integrity. To run a church properly means, good friends, at least the following things. It means making sure the building, the grounds do not get run down or the staff exploited. Lots of beautiful churches slide into decadence without anybody noticing until it really starts raining inside the church. And many churches operate as genteel sweatshops. Our national association has adopted compensation guidelines to help us in avoiding falling into such practices. It is a measure of our institutional integrity. But the truth is, it takes a lot of money to keep this place functional, beautiful, safe, and responsive to our mission as a church. The proposed budget for next year is $495,000. It is an honest and bare-bones budget. The average cost for each member and household is approximately $2,000. Those of us who can afford to pay this amount, those whose income levels allow them to do so and do not, are being unfairly subsidized by others, many of whom are making sacrifices to do so. For some, $2,000 would be an unfair burden. But I want to say this. This church is not a charity to which we contribute. We are a cooperative, endeavoring to be fair and equitable in our financial relationships with one another. Fair share pledging is fair and it is ethical. And what we give, we are giving to ourselves, our church family, this beloved community, and its mission in the larger world. I'm also aware of the extraordinary generosity of many persons here in the past and present. The building and sustaining of this beautiful 100-year-old church and its Hope Chapel, the commitment many made and continue to make to this church, the commitment of keeping this beautiful church is a testimony to the commitment many made and continue to make to this church. But I have heard too often and too many occasions the word can't. Good friends, we don't have money problems so much as we have what I would describe as a commitment problem. We are a prosperous congregation, and according to demographic studies, Unitarian Universalists are the richest denomination in America. I also know we are, according to SAT scores, the smartest denomination as well. But we are also the denomination in which it is membership, in which its membership gives the least in comparison to others. So let's stop using all that brain power to rationalize our tight-fisted financial practices. The money is there, and it is a blessing and an opportunity. I recently read that birds flying in formation, that is called cooperation and commitment, increase their aerodynamic efficiency by 70% in comparison to what they do as a single bird. Can you imagine what would happen if we really came together as a church and flew right? I mean, if we gave 3 to 5% of our income to the church, there was almost nothing we could not do in program, music, our children's religious education programs, making neglected building repairs, and our commitment to a larger social ministry in St. Louis. We can do anything this congregation wants and needs to do. Let's talk about the money that is available and forthcoming to give to this place, not this charity, but this cooperative in which all of us are members. Let's begin to talk about money and the meaning of our lives with integrity, common sense, and vision. This church can be greater than it has ever dreamed. In this place where our deepest hopes are enshrined, where pain is soothed, humanity celebrated, where friendships are made, where brokenness is healed and bad habits kicked, where the sacred is encountered and new hope is born, where groups conform and reform an evil world, where we gather to live out our mission to build the free church, to liberate the spirit, to create the beloved community. Good people, dear friends, come on. Let us advance and proclaim the healing gospel of the free church to a world that is in need of its transforming vision in these times, its embracing loving message, and its faithful democratic practices. Let us go forward with a renewed commitment and greater integrity. Amen, amen, and bless all of you.